Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, that podcast focused on a zero emission future that we all hope for. Now, every week we get fabulous guests, and this week is no exception. As you all know, you've clicked on the link and you know that we are talking to Will Rowe of Octopus, or should we call it Swaptopus? Will, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me. Very excited about this.
Yeah, no, and John, who is the EV Cafe team member joining me this week, and I are very excited too. John, welcome. We're looking forward to this one, aren't we?
Very much so. It bothers me slightly, though, that with all the things that Will's got going on, this is exciting for him.
John, you put yourself down. Everybody loves meeting with the lovely John Curtis.
I wasn't putting me down, mate.
Oh, you put me down. Right, fair enough. Right. I'll just leave you two to chat, shall I? Anyway, no.
So, Will, thanks for joining me.
Yeah.
So, Will, on a serious note, listen, things have just got pretty bloomin' exciting in your world. I know that you've been, in and around the world of electrification for a little while, but, you know, you've just taken on something pretty big. But you've also done something that we are all pretty interested in also, and are now not doing that, which is interesting too. So, listen, give us a quick snapshot of what you're doing today, and then we can sort of dive into a little bit about that, and then a bit about your history and so on.
Yeah, cool. So, I have got what probably could describe as one of the most fun jobs in the world, because I my title is Entrepreneur in Residence at Octopus Energy. So obviously,
wow, cool.
Yeah, very given cool Octopus title. Given Octopus is very innovative generally, being trusted with trying to create new businesses within the Octopus Energy Group is very exciting. The reason why I do that job is because I am not particularly good at normal sort of corporate work. Not that Octopus is corporate, but you know, like, I'm not that good at that sort of stuff. I'm quite good at trying to start businesses, but I kind of have had the belief that unless you can find a business that is going to be huge and goes on that kind of VC style journey, you're better off working with people who have capital and capabilities to try and build a business that you can scale more quickly and have more impact more quickly. And so right now, the business that we're just launching is called Swaptopus, which was a name I made up for it, which has stuck. So we're going to stick with it. So it's a HGV battery swapping business, which is a joint venture between Octopus Energy Group and CATL, the world's largest battery maker. What we've been looking at HGVs for a long time. So long that previously I tried a hydrogen business in that space, which I'm happy to talk about. But In electrification of HGV, there's a few kind of significant challenges, we think. One is the rollout of the grid. Like, that is difficult to do, to get grid connections to all locations that need it. The other is the downtime penalty of charging. And, you know, yes, it might align to driver brace, et cetera, but as you move to a world of autonomy and you couple the grid to where the driver brace needs to be, it becomes difficult. And the third is just optimizing the cost. So yes, you know, if you're a domestic customer, you can get EV tariffs at 7-8p a night by Octopus and others. But in the world of HGVs, you know, a HGV sitting there waiting for off-peak charging is not ideal. You know, you want the HGV on the road earning money, and then you need to charge it when it suits to charge it. So the correlation of charging times with off-peak energy is not that great. So it's difficult to come with a kind of a grid rollout, no charging downtime, and low-cost energy solution. And so we kind of looked at it and went, do you know what? Battery swapping ticks all of those boxes, because it decouples the duty cycle of the vehicle from the charging cycle. It's fast. It takes 5 minutes. And we can own the infrastructure, so we can roll it out where it suits for us and our customers and then get higher utilization. And you're not trying to go through a conversation with landlords, with every individual customer of the exact positioning in their depot, because depot electrification is, you know, a challenge, not to mention, you know, coupling that with ports and service stations and all those sort of places. We can just roll out the infrastructure where it works for our network based on the customers at the time. And so we looked around for the technology that we thought was the best and identified that in China, CATL already run a network of 305 stations, going to be 900 by the end of 2027. and so said to CATL, look, why don't, one, you bring your technology to Europe, but two, do it under a joint venture so that A, you've got skin in the game, and B, between Octopus and yourselves, we can scale up the core capabilities, you know, technology provision in the hardware from CATL in terms of batteries and swapping stations and energy procurement from Octopus, which then leaves the kind of the only bit in the middle is the bit I have to worry about, which is growing the business and being nice to customers.
But you're being very modest, Will, in that you position this as a transport play, but actually what you're doing is building power stations. You guys are going to absolutely dominate energy storage with all of these batteries lying around, storing fabulous energy, renewables, I hope. And that's a great thing. So there's a massive infrastructure play here. It's not just about trucks. This is about how the country stores energy.
Yeah, like the obvious thing to do when you've got hundreds or if not thousands, if not millions of batteries sitting there waiting to go into trucks is to use them as a VPP, so a virtual power plant. So to take energy when it's cheap and provide grid services and or export that energy at periods when it's more expensive or the grid needs it. So yeah, that's 100% our strategy. We're not going to dress that up and pretend it's not. You know, it is a play. I suppose the one thing to flag though is, you know, vehicle grade lithium ion batteries are more expensive than, say, grid scale sodium batteries that will be coming in due course. So we have an inherent sort of capex disadvantage, but at the same time, we have some advantages because a big part of the cost of a grid scale energy project is not just the cells itself, it's everything else. It's the transformers, it's the land, it's the grid connection. And so we already have to pay for those things anyway from a transport lens. So, you know, we think the difference in cell cost is effectively irrelevant and we can utilize our batteries better.
Absolutely. I think what I'm trying to do is make it obvious to everybody who's listening to this that you have your eyes on a macro system. This isn't just let's electrify a few trucks and that battery swap is the ideal way of doing that. This is a massive energy play, which will not only revolutionize renewables and storage, but transport. It's a huge opportunity for the UK to work not only with a massive Chinese brand, and Paul and I were in Beijing recently, and saw the power of CATL, a brilliant partner, but you are going to rule the world.
Well, I hope so, but obviously there's quite a lot to do between now and then. And the thing to note is, you know, although the VPB play and the transport play all make sense and it fits together really nicely, the bit that's probably frustrated me, let's say, is the obsession with governments and policymakers with things like data centers, which is new load that doesn't need to exist, whereas trucks is like an easy win, right? The electrification wins on cost and it's load that is otherwise going to imported diesel. So it's like a win-win. So one of the big things we're trying to do is prove that it works so that we can scale this up. And so that a load of demand for fossil fuels that otherwise won't go away, turns straight into electric demand. Whereas something like shipping, aviation, it's much harder. Like, I don't think there's an easy route to decarbonising those things. And so, you know, I think we should, personally, I don't think we should be investing in the technologies to get there because I don't think they're going to be commercially viable. But data centres is one of those ones where I'm like, you know, lots of governments will have a data centre strategy for this region or this. And I'm like, why not have a truck electrification strategy? If all the trucks in the UK go electric, it'll be 32 terawatt hours of annual demand, which is about a 15 to 20% increase in the total amount of energy we use. So that just lowers everyone else's bills because that's all new demand that's going into the denominator. So like, it's an easy win. And so that's why we're targeting it.
Do you know, it's super interesting, but I will just explain to the audience that you're in a tennis club as we speak, and we've got a little bit of background noise occasionally. So
sorry, I think they've all gone now. Everyone's gone now.
I was going to say, they've all gone.
yeah. Sorry.
That's absolutely fine. But we must just show our appreciation for you still sticking to the time despite having sold your house yesterday and effectively moving out. So we're very grateful that you found a little spot, even though occasionally we get a little bit of background noise. That's all right. But to come back to the point in hand, you know, the idea of there being a revenue play behind the sort of electrification of vehicles. I mean, one of the things that, as I've mentioned probably many times on these podcasts, is that, that you know, with the electrification of the bin lorries in Westminster, there is literally 12 megawatts of batteries driving in and out of a small site just outside of the Westminster sort of area. And coming back with 70% charge every day. So they've still got around 9 megawatts or thereabouts to be able to just use on a regular basis in and out. And so I think people are currently missing that opportunity. So what will be great is to see how you monetize the electrification process and start to generate revenue out of it, and then demonstrate that to the rest of the world to say, look, actually, yes, okay, we're having to put out a bit of money up front, but we're actually going to monetize this process, and the total cost of ownership and the ROI will come back to us. Is that how you see it? Is it going to be, is that where you see it being most effective?
Yeah, well, so simplistically, and I don't know if you've ever looked at like the cost stack of energy provision, but effectively, you know, the simplistic bit is to first of all avoid demand. So the cheapest energy you can do is to avoid importing from the grid, typically, and either self-generating or shift the time when you import so that you're consuming something on site yourself. Now, obviously, with something like a HEV, we don't have that option because the HEV needs the power. It's going to drive off and do its duty cycle and then come back. So you're not offsetting, say, the factory's demand that you're next to. But in a domestic sense, that's where you win. The first kilowatt hour is the cheapest one you miss there. But then after that, you've got the wholesale arbitrage. You've got the grid cost arbitrage. You've got ancillary markets like flexibility, voltage, et cetera, et cetera. And so the beauty of someone like Ultrabus is that whole stack can kind of get monetized, and that's how they offer such cheap overnight rates for EV drivers. Now, with the HGV play, obviously, we're going to try and monetize all of those things based on how long our HGV swapping stations got in terms of depth and what like export, import capabilities we have, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, that is 100% the bit. I suppose the one thing I'd add to that is that we don't have infinite storage in the sense of you can only store so many batteries relative to how fast you have to swap them. So the trick for us is to get the perfect balance, and this is not yet proven what the perfect balance is, between how many batteries we store versus how big our grid connection is versus how utilized our station is. And that will change based on location. So for example, in Spain, it makes sense to have 3 or 4 hours of storage because you get 4-ish hours of basically free electricity almost every day because of the solar surplus. Now, in a geography that's dominated by wind, it's slightly different because you tend to get multiple days of wind generation and then days without wind. So but you can't have multiple days of storage. So then the arbitrage is a different play. So you've got to have geography specific strategies, which will come down to the location, the nearest city, substation, weather patterns, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to be very exciting building out the network.
I guess your secret weapon in all of this, Will, is Kraken.
So Kraken is more like the plumbing, let's say, and Ultrabus Energy Group is the one that does the kind of the optimization, the trading, the actual intelligence. So Kraken is really like a calculator. So a customer of Kraken, any customer of Kraken, you know, Eon's a customer of Kraken, there's others, they could do the same play. So actually Kraken's more like the connectivity and the plumbing end of it, and the intelligence sits within Ultrabus.
I suppose the point is that you use multiple systems to be able to flex the different areas that you have control over to make the business work. And what you're illustrating here is that in one country it's X, Y, and Z, in another country it's A, B, and C, but you're using AI and the huge systems that you have within Ultrabus, including Kraken, to be able to unlock that box in the most profitable way possible.
Yeah, like that. Ultimately, software plus AI is the key to being able to work in a dynamic, flexible energy system. You know, in the old world, it was power plants turn up and down based on calls from the control center and demanded and really flex. Whereas in the new world, it's going to be a combination of intermittent generation sources that require more and more optimization against from a demand perspective and intelligent software to tackle those different opportunities to make sure that the system stays in balance and you achieve the lowest possible cost.
Yep.
Mm. There's so many questions flying around in my head, but I'm going to stick with my thought process.
We should talk about trucks. Trucks are easy.
Well, I'm going to come on to that right now, because I'm much more linear. I am a van man, as you know, but I don't mind a truck. And when we were in China, I mean, I saw a battery swapping technology going on. A NIO was one demonstrating it, and I called it out as something that would be good for vans. Now, I realise that that's not the play that you're going for. You're going for trucks, and I can understand why that would be. CATL, I also called out as a technology, because they're swapping. I think it was 2 minutes, 31 seconds for NIO and 99 seconds for CATL to swap a battery with their stations. And they both had their stations on show, which was great. And then as I was walking round, I stumbled across, and I can't remember the name of it. It's annoying. It doesn't really matter, I suppose. But a giant, what looked like a giant containerized worm with wheels. And it was huge. I mean, it was, probably 30 tons, but, you know, most of that payload. And fully autonomous, no cab, and just huge batteries. And I was sort of walking around it, and Cargo Bot, that was what it was called. And they said, 821 kilometers at a go. Oh, by the way, we'll just swap the batteries out at the end of it, and then we'll come back. And I'm like, so 821 kilometers, 5 minutes, turn those batteries around, come back, 1600 kilometers without a stop, without, you know, any kind of aggro. That's not physically possible in today's world, you know, in any sort of scenario, because it takes 20 minutes, I think, to fill a truck with fuel, you know.
I think your point here is actually really interesting on a macro. So right now, a lot of the way the transition for HGVs to go from diesel to electric is thought through is with a driver in the cab. And so you've got intrinsic design limitations of having to have a cab. Yeah. From an aero perspective, from a length perspective, from a weight perspective, and also driver brakes. And I'm not saying being a HGV driver is not a valuable thing, but you can easily imagine a future in the 2030s whereby certain routes where we have known traffic and you know, you're not driving through city centres with very large vehicles, etc., go with more and more autonomy. And with that autonomy, it opens up the opportunity to significantly redesign the vehicle, because you can have no cab, you can have the payload spread out across the axles better. You know, you can envisage a world whereby more of the length is utilized for payload as well, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yeah, that's one of our macro hypotheses, is that we end up with a world where, well, one of our customers is talking to us about this. They say they're going to go from 60 hours a week utilization of a truck to 160, and there's 168 hours in a week. And their vision is a fully autonomous 24/7 effective operation with battery swapping supporting that. And that's also got material implications for the industry. And I don't want to overstate these, but, you know, right now, the two biggest costs to a HGV operator is labor and fuel. Now, in a world where labor's gone and fuel is electric, all of a sudden, there's a difference in how that looks. And so whether or not the whole shape of the industry will be the same in say, 15, 20 years' time, I don't know. I don't know if independent operators will be able to compete in the world of buying electrons in that system. So either a system like ours, where you can buy the electrons at the same price as everyone else, will work, or it will be a world where there's a lot of consolidation into some very large centralized players trying to compete. And so it's going to be an interesting and very disruptive time period, I think, with autonomy and the move to electric.
Will, I think you are 100% right. What I think people are missing here is that we are fundamentally changing. And so what we've got is two rivers colliding, and they're going to form one giant river of change. And we've got a perfect storm in that we haven't got the drivers. You're right. We haven't got drivers. We haven't got enough. And so the labor cost of said drivers is going up and up and up and up. And the battle, the fight to get the drivers in the right place. So we've got driver problem, number one. Fuel, we know the volatility of fuel. But we've also got the demand to change to electric and, you know, see everything coming down the pipe. But autonomy has now come in from the sort of left field. People didn't realize that this was happening, but it's actually live. We've seen it physically with our own eyes in China, and we've seen it on the streets of London with, you know, Waymo, and we know that all across the world this is happening. And I think unless we bet in the way that you guys are, we're going to miss the boat massively. And I think people just need to wake up and realize that it's not going to do anybody out of any jobs. It is going to be financially beneficial. It's going to turn the truck industry possibly into a bit more profit. So, I mean, I think it's really exciting. You obviously are a person that loves change.
Well, it's true, yeah. That probably is true, yeah.
So talk to us about that, this entrepreneur in residence. We'll come on to hydrogen after that because, you know, that was a big elephant to eat.
Well, I'll tell you a quick story before I do hydrogen, if that's all right. So when I had a job in a bank, like a investment bank, when I first left uni. And anyway, the year before that job, I'd worked with Stephen, who founded Ovo. So I was sort of the eighth employee at Ovo, did a bit of everything and loved it. I loved the entrepreneurship and the dynamism. And I loved the challenger feeling of we were trying to do something different. You know, the big six were charging 20% gross margin. We came in with a tariff that was 10% gross margin. And so we were, you know, £150 a year cheaper. And we were, you know, we were great. Everything about it was great. And then I went back to Ovo and started one business and then did another business. And it was myself and somebody else suggested that we should start the business Kaluza, which was the energy tech platform. And so I suppose you're right. Like, change was always something that I was very passionate about, like, okay, this is how we do things today. If you take a step back and say, how could you completely reinvent it? Not just make material, because lots of people are good at process improvement or, you know, incremental change, but it's more saying, what's the macro opportunity here and how do we completely reshape this? So I suppose, yeah, I do like that sort of thing. And that's why then I knew Greg from before and so said to Greg, look, we did one business in smart metering together, but then I said, look, we should do a hydrogen business. And the reason why we said we should do a hydrogen business was because of the challenges I described around electrification of HGVs. I was like, look, these challenges are quite difficult to overcome. And so if we can produce hydrogen in locations where we've got excess and curtailed renewable energy and distribute it to end use applications, we're completely decoupling the generation of energy from the use of energy. Now, the bit we got wrong was that decoupling doesn't work financially. So, like, theoretically, you know, I can take wind in the North Sea that's being wasted and turn it into a molecule, ship the molecule somewhere, and then use that molecule as a source of electricity that's green. That's great. Problem is, you lose a third of it at the start and a third of it at the end. And so in between, you've increased your cost by 200%. So that's the problem with hydrogen. And the other problem is obviously there's a lot of bait and switch tactics being done by oil and gas companies and things like that. And so from something like mobility, it just doesn't work. The vehicles are too expensive. The production is too expensive. The distribution is too expensive. The storage is too expensive. Everything about hydrogen, even if you take away any of the other arguments about its potential merits to the energy system, which I don't actually really buy anymore either, is it's just too expensive, full stop. And my other big issue with it is this narrative of energy security just doesn't work. You know, there is no energy security narrative in wasting two-thirds of the energy that you've just produced. So it just doesn't work. And so, you know, I suppose the proof point would be China, because China could choose any strategy it wants, right? It's got the budget to do it. It has the technical capability and engineering culture, and it doesn't have fossil fuels in terms of oil, so it's only really got coal. Okay, and so what strategy has China done? I mean, yes, the hydrogen advocates say it's done a bit of hydrogen, but I think the last time I checked, it was something like battery electric sales were outselling hydrogen. It was sort of like 1,000 to 1, and they're both under the same subsidy regime. So, I mean, case study, that is the end of it. There is no future for hydrogen, because if unless someone like China was seriously trying to invest in it and produce it, it's just not going to happen. And so that's why, it ends. Done. There is no hydrogen story.
So, because the thing that then strikes me about all of this, because, you know, entrepreneurs and this is clearly your gifting, have to fail to learn. And how does failure feel for you? I mean, is it failure or is it just learning? How do you describe it?
I think there's two things on this for me. So one is, it is definitely a failure, and it's personal, and it hurts, and it's miserable, and you feel bad for your investors, you feel terrible for your employees, the people that trusted you. Like, there's a lot of stuff in there that you can't dress up as a nice, good learning experience. It's just terrible. On the other hand, I think learning through doing and taking risks and then understanding what you did well, what you did badly, and therefore how you're going to internalize that and move forward is a positive step. So for example, you know, I'm not sure I would be as competent, let's say, if I am competent, at trying to tackle the electrification of HGVs without having tried and failed somewhere else. And so, for example, the thing I realized was I really like the challenge of talking to fleets and fleet directors and sustainability people and CEOs of businesses that move things around the world, whether that be shippers or carriers, and saying, I think we've got a solution for you that works cost competitively, that works for your duty cycle, that works with your needs. So like, I really enjoy that. I'm passionate about that. I like talking to policymakers about what needs to happen there. And I like talking to investors about why they should get on board with that. So I realized I really like that thing. I just picked the wrong solution the first time around, which was hydrogen. So actually, you know, take what you like doing and then find a better solution to do it better, you know. And it was the same with trying to build software businesses like Kaluza or a Kraken. You know, like, yes, companies need to be run more operationally efficient and be able to offer tariffs to customers quicker that tackle the wholesale market and the flexibility markets and can be more innovative. And again, you know, Kraken is a world leader there relative to some other businesses, let's say, you know. So if you like the problem, you can continue to iterate until you find the right solution. I think sometimes people maybe get too obsessed with their version of the solution and then just want to stick with that. And I think that dogma isn't an entrepreneurial mindset or a learning mindset. That's just dogmatic, you know. So like, and I think also that is where things like nuclear and stuff struggles. Like, I quite like nuclear in principle, but the problem with nuclear is it's very, very hard to learn and iterate on it, right? You can't really get it wrong. and so it's tough, right? Whereas, you know, solar panels, you can, or whatever, batteries, you can to an extent. You know, they're modular, they're relatively cheap compared to, you know, a power station, etc. So I've got a lot of sympathy for people that run big infrastructure things like grids and power stations, but at the same time, they are risk-averse and slow, and they're difficult to deal with.
If you operate a fleet of cars or vans, you'll know electric is the future. Transitioning to EVs can appear daunting, but with Europe Car, it's effortless. Our long-term EV rentals eliminate the upfront costs, contract commitments, and uncertainty. Instead, you'll get total flexibility, a wide choice of cars and vans, and Europe Car's expert support. So, make the switch without the stress and experience Europe Karma. Search Europe Car Business.
Will, you spoke earlier about the challenges that there are of fitting into a corporate environment, and that because of the job you do, entrepreneur in residence, Octopus has given you that kind of corporate financial stability and a playground, a place to go and express yourself. And I get a sense that you don't fit into boxes very easily, that you are somebody who thinks outside of the lines, that is always questioning, is looking for problems to solve and rapidly coming up with solutions. Would I be right in that assessment of you, and that you've always been that sort of person who just wants to challenge? You see things and see the world in a completely unique way.
Well, maybe unique might be generous, but definitely I struggle a big part of corporate success, let's say, is A, taking people on the journey with you. And I don't just mean like selling a vision to them, but it's like stakeholder management, things like that. And again, I must flag, Octopus is great. Like, Octopus, if you had to do these sort of things, Octopus is a really good place to do it. There's very low politics, it's easy communication channels. Like, so I'm not trying to say Octopus is a corporate. Like, I used to work at Barclays, which is a different world, right? But I suppose the biggest thing I think with being an entrepreneurial person or trying to start something yourself is that you have to be willing to just not be very good at most of things too, but you're better than someone who's not willing to do it. So I'm like, I'm all right at financial modeling. I'm all right at building a website. I'm all right at talking to customers. I'm all right at cold outreach on LinkedIn, you know, and I'm sure there's somebody who's better than me at every one of those verticals. I'm putting up 150 things like choosing trucks and understanding requirements and all of these things. Like, there is definitely people who are better than me at everything, but I reckon I'm probably 1% better than the people who are not good at these things at everything. And so I just do enough of them to make progress. And I think that's the difference. In a corporate, normally, the point is you manage to hire people who are good at each of the disciplines. So why not utilize them? The problem is then you've got competing priorities. You've got different, priorities. You've got different motivations, you know, different politics at times. There's all sorts of stuff going on that make your project not the thing that needs to happen. And that's why companies struggle to get new stuff done. And so, you know, the beauty of working in an entrepreneurial world is you kind of, well, if I don't get it done, it just won't happen. So I just have to do it is the way I sort of see it.
You're very modest and, you know, I'm not very good at this. I'm not very good at that. I see within you that, you know, we talk about neuronormality, if you like. We talk about neurodivergence and we talk about neural normal. And I get a sense that there's a divergence in you, which you embrace. And whilst you're absolutely focused on being the best you can at the things you do, you must have a superpower. Neurodivergent people all have this one thing that they can do. And I just get the sense that there's something in you that you are absolutely shit hot at. What is that thing?
But you know what? So interestingly, my daughter just had an assessment for ADHD and dyslexia, and she's got both. I've got three kids, but when you read the report, I'm like, oh, that is literally me in a case study of like
snap.
And the thing it says though is interestingly now they try and make the person who's got these things feel better about it by telling them that companies look to hire these sort of neurodivergent things and stuff. Whereas when I was growing up, you just got told you were disruptive and hard work and you know, like, well, I remember because I got diagnosed with dyslexia when I was 18 and I had a reading age of 6. So I'd done my A levels with a reading age of 6 and I managed to pass with 2 A's and a B, and I don't know how I did it because I couldn't really read. And I hated school. I hated everything about it. And then I went to uni and I actually quite enjoyed it, but it took, you know, I went to uni through clearing. I had no plans to go to uni and I got good grades. I was like, oh, I'll just go to uni. And I suppose, so I don't, by the way, I say this is a superpower, but probably my superpower is just being resilient in the sense of like, you don't know what you don't know. So you just do what you do, don't you? And I suppose I'm not saying that's a good way for everybody to deal with it, because I've probably been blessed with confidence. And if you're not confident, you probably need mechanisms to help you be more confident. But I suppose, yeah, like I just remember growing up, my mum would just tell me, like, you could do anything. And I know a lot of parents will say that, but in the sense of she was very much like, you can literally do anything. She had no concept of, she was, you know, my mum's working class. She's got no like, oh, you could be an astronaut kind of thing. But she'd be like, just if you want to do it, you can do anything you want. And she never really had a concept of even like, there was a sensible like, well, you're unlikely to, you know, become an astronaut. Well, she'd just be like, yeah, you could be an astronaut. Whereas right. I suppose the problem is the more educated you are, maybe that you go, well, probability wise, you're probably not going to be an astronaut, are you? And actually, that's not a good narrative. Just tell them they can do it and then let them solve the problem themselves in a way.
would you say that your mum has been one of your big influences in your life?
Certainly on a confidence perspective, you know, confidence to talk to people, to believe in yourself, you know, those sort of attributes, not necessarily like academically or anything like that, but for sure, yeah, because I think you need someone in your life to, I would say this, especially because I've got two girls. I've got two girls and a boy. And I say, if you can't be a cheerleader for your own daughters, especially because girls tend to lack confidence, just to say that, I think that's true. Like, who else is going to be their cheerleader for them? So I'm like, I try and just say to my girls, you could do anything you want in the whole. I say to my son too, but I just worry less about his confidence. But I'm like, if your parents aren't your cheerleaders, who else is going to be? You don't need your parents to be a voice of reason. You need them to be a voice of. I was talking to someone the other day, actually, and I said the other day, about a year ago, I went to Norway. And we were talking, he was saying that his son, he's concerned about his son's like revision level at school and focus and stuff. And I said, this is not the best parenting advice. But I said, but I've always gone with the parenting advice to my kids of, you need to learn to do the minimum possible to tick the goal and to focus on things you want to do thereafter. So like, again, one of the things of entrepreneurship is like, I could spend my life getting this heads of turns better and this marketing material better. But I could also just get it to an extent where I can send it out and get some feedback on it and see where I'm going. And then I can move on to task number two. Because people are like, so they'll say to you, how do you get so much stuff done on your own? And you're like, well, it's just doing a lot of things not as well as that you would do is probably what I do.
You know, I'm just glad you're not a brain surgeon.
So one of my best friends is an engineer, right? And he will join the business in due course. And he does things like, worries about building bridges and stuff like that. And you're like, I would be the worst person to work, because I'm like, well, surely that's good enough, right?
Yeah. 80% good enough.
It'll be fine. And then and you realise, like, well, they don't have that luxury. So there's a completely different skill set there, isn't there? You know, I'd be terrible at building bridges because they would all fall down. And, you know,
But Will, can I just I was yesterday with Openreach, and we had a room full of 40 kids, right? 40 kids of 16 to 19 years old, and I articulated my journey to them, which is a journey of death and destruction as a kid. I was terrible at school, had no qualifications, got in all kinds of trouble, blah, blah, blah. And then at 21, fell into the work market and started cleaning cars. And now, you know, I am the person I am. And I'm like, I'm sort of scratching my head because nobody ever said to me, oh, you can do anything. In fact, you know, quite the opposite. And confidence, you've mentioned confidence. I think confidence is one of the biggest blessings, because you can kind of go into a room, go into a job, go into anything, sport, whatever it might be. And confidence is actually something that, you know, the big stars, you know, can bottle, right? You know, they've got that. What would you say to your 16-year-old self? Because, you know, you were probably in the middle of all of that. You were struggling to read. You were feeling perhaps that ADHD kind of, I can't concentrate, I can't focus on anything. Looking back, just condense what we've just talked about, really, into just some advice for your 16-year-old self.
So some advice I would give people that are not me at this point, but just thinking through to someone younger, one of the things I say to my nieces and nephews and stuff is like, and I sometimes realize you need to caveat things slightly, but I'm like, don't be in a rush to get a job, because in the one hand, getting a job is really important. Like, I did loads of jobs when I was younger, you know, delivered pizzas, worked in a garden center, worked as a woodyard, I worked in a restaurant. Like, I did loads of different jobs. I enjoyed them all, sometimes multiple ones at the same time, you know, two or three over the course of a week, you know. And I just really liked that. I liked earning money, even though, like, I didn't really spend on anything useful. I just liked the financial independence. I liked the concepts of what it was. I don't know, just something that motivated. So, like, I'm not work shy from that perspective. But what I think sometimes is kind of drilled into young people too much today is like, well, you need to work out the qualifications you want to do to get the job you want, so then you've got a career that's stable and then you can end up here. And I'm like, sometimes it's not that good a plan, you know. Like, why don't you just sort of say embrace opportunities and see where you can go? And I realized, like, that, you know, look, if it depends on your background, right? If your parents aren't wealthy or whatever it may be, like, taking loads of risk is not for everyone, right? It's difficult. But at the same time, being in a rush to just nail down something too kind of constrict, what's the word, like, prescriptive, you know, like a defined career too early can probably be relatively limited. And I struggle to see then how you get out of that and where you go with it. So I'd be like, you know, so I say to my nieces and nephews, like, you should go traveling. Like, I'll lend you the money to go traveling. I'd rather you spend a year traveling and at least just decide what you want to do a bit before you rush into going to uni or going to work, you know. But also I'm like, but then don't just become a beach bum and spend 5 years, you know, working in a surf shack in Indonesia. Like, between the two is the right balance. Like, don't be in a rush to be boring, but don't be in a don't avoid stuff. Because, you know, that'd be for me, luckily enough, I did some of those things, again, because I'd worked a lot and I didn't really know what I needed to do or what I wanted to do, and was fortunate where I landed up. But I think for me, it would be, yeah, just, I don't want to say, like, believe in the process, because I didn't really have a process, but more like, Just believe in yourself. But I mean, I've been incredibly lucky. Most things are down to luck, right? And sometimes it's a blend of being willing to take risks and luck and execution. So, for example, I'd say, just as a story, I built a business once that was very successful, and I didn't really see any of the upside in the business that we built. And so that taught me not to be a mug multiple times in a row. You know, if you're going to build businesses, make sure that you get your fair share of the value you create. And in achieving that value creation, you then unlock some freedom for yourself that lets you take more risks. And in so doing that, you also get confidence of the value you can bring. Yes, I can define, say something I'm going to achieve and do it, and that creates value for somebody else, and therefore more people are willing to invest in me. So, you know, someone might say, how have you managed to convince Octopus and CATL to invest in a joint venture? I'm like, well, I'd like to think part of it is because I've successfully done business with Octopus before, and so they believe in my capability to execute on this thing. And I have to work very hard at that, but that, you know, it's, the trust is there through delivering things in the past as much as it is, you know, great stories and a CV, and not that I have a great CV, but it's about a blend of those things, you know. It's so that's what I'd say, you know, build trust with people through delivery, and don't be in a rush to make decisions that are too prescriptive for the rest of your life.
Do you know what? It was really interesting. We had, you know, obviously a number of business leaders talking to those kids yesterday, and pretty much that was what would, you know, have a bit of confidence, trust the process or lack of process, you know, however you kind of picture that, and don't be in a rush to kind of go particularly, and realize that actually you can do a number of different things through your life. But there's one thing that I always hear said when people mention luck, but you know, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And I think that is definitely been true in your case.
Wow, talking of tennis, I saw a statistic that Novak Djokovic hit more serves on the lines than anyone else in Wimbledon history. Is that luck, or is that because he's aiming for the lines? You know, the reality is, it's a bit of both, right? He's probably hit more serves because he's been there for longer. He's won more matches. Yeah. And, you know, it's not luck, is it, really, some of it?
No, you've got to go for it. Go.
Talking of hard work, Will, I'm fascinated to understand, because I have an insight into how the neurodivergent mind works. And here's a man who's got an idea, big idea, could change the world, and you're following that path. Nonetheless, your brain is wired in such a way that you're looking at 100 different things that you could also do, side hustles and various things, problems that need sorting. What's the thing that's calling you? Other than this particular Swaptopus project, what's the thing in your head that's saying, yeah, I really need to deal with that, or yeah, this is going to be big?
I would say one of the things I've learned is that if you focus on things, it's better than not. So, like, for example, I probably look at almost every business in the clean tech space, in the sense of, you know, whether that be putting batteries behind the meter in people's homes, in front of the meter, solar plus battery, heat pump with solar plus battery, depot electrification, static charging, decarbonization, aviation, ships, battery swapping ships. Like I've, you know, you name it, I've looked at everything, hybrid rail solutions. Like I love looking at new ideas. And I suppose what you do is you keep going through and going, can I do this? Like, can I do this? And some of them you think maybe I could, but it's hard. Maybe someone's better, you know, and then with this one, I just was like, look, this feels like one where the market's very big and it will have an impact if we nail it. I think the biggest thing for me, though, is economic tailwinds. There's a lot of good ideas out there that have sustainability credentials that are not economically viable. And the problem with those is if you're trying to place a green premium or some form of non-economic incentive on the operator to do something, or so on a customer to do something, you're at the whim of policy or social media, whatever the thing is that influences someone to do it, it can go away. Whereas if it's economics, it's a cold, hard, long-term reality that will be in your favor. And so that's what I liked about trucks. I was like, this is the biggest untapped, economically viable opportunity I can see in the energy transition. So that's why I find it quite easy now to focus on that thing only, because I don't have a better idea right now of the things I'd like to tackle, if that makes sense. Now, what's interesting is, like, I was going to say, I've also looked at things like eVTOL and all this sort of stuff. And some of these things, like, potentially are great, but it's like, I don't think they go away. I mean, I'm not a massive fan of eVTOL, but I'm like, I think if I can nail trucks over the next 15 years, a lot of those potential next routes through the battery scale that comes from trucking, et cetera, those things become more and more possible. So I kind of see it as a good enabling step, a bit like, you know, solar plus smartphones has enabled cars, and then cars enable trucks, and trucks will enable some other things to happen. It's kind of the stepping stones I see.
Amazing. Will, you're now going to get your first reprimand. You did so well. You did VPP and you gave virtual power plant. You said it, and then you dropped eVTOL and didn't explain that for our poor audience who are now going, "What the hell's an eVTOL?" So electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicle. So in other words, a giant drone. Would that be right?
Yes, and I've looked at them with and without passengers, with and without pilots, different applications, et cetera, et cetera. It's an interesting market. There's a reason why I don't work in it. Let's put it that way.
Indeed. Well, I think China have gone big on it, haven't they? They're really dialing into that over the next few years. But I think one of the things that was curious for me, because Octopus, of course, have pretty much dominated the UK market now. They're number one in the energy space. They're at the front of the queue in every tech play. You're now looking at trucking. But what was interesting to me was that this is very clearly a beyond UK shores kind of play. So this is now, you're partnering with the biggest company, battery company in the world in CATL, a Chinese company. And pretty much this is a European play for, you know, battery swapping across Europe. Was this a perfectly timed opportunity from Octopus's point of view to think, actually, we can expand beyond the UK shores and really move out into Europe and the wider world? Or is that just fortuitous?
So Octopus has been in different European countries from a supply perspective for quite a few years. So like it's owned the business in Germany for over five, I think, you know, so it's in Spain, Germany, Italy, France already. And so really the reason why it's pan-European is, one, trucks are, you know, Europe is a relatively homogenous trucking market. There is variances with the right-hand drive, left-hand drive, but like form factor wise is similar. So, you know, a swapping station that works in the UK will work in Europe. There's no material difference, and a standard for batteries that works will work in Europe. And the OEMs, you know, if you're making a vehicle for UK, it will work in Europe subject to changing the cab. Like there's no material differences other than unless you want to talk about 6x2s versus 4x2s in the tractor units, which is one of the banes of my life at the moment, I must say. And so really it was a case of, it's a great opportunity for Octopus to leverage its capabilities across Europe. So for example, in Spain, in Germany, in Italy. And then there's some geographies within Europe that Octopus doesn't supply in, so such as Poland and some of the Nordics and stuff, where we see lots of tailwinds from an electrification of trucking perspective, but Octopus can't supply there directly because of the way the market structure is, or because of the way the value is created within the market. And so those are markets we're going to have to look at. How do we tackle collectively through the joint venture and through Octopus and CATL's kind of, you know, help? I think where notable absences is that we're not doing this in Japan, Australia and America, which are markets where Octopus has supply capability, and there may or may not be merits to battery swapping. Some are just like Australia, just because it's a long way away and we haven't got around to looking at it properly yet. But then others, it's because of things like, well, the truck market is quite unique, so it's maybe its own type of truck, let's say, or the incumbent OEM is one that doesn't really embrace electrification yet. You could guess which geography that would be. So there's certain criteria. You know, Europe feels like a good place to launch this because the technology, and to be honest with you, the biggest factor in Europe is the grid issues. Europe, I don't want to say we should be building grid more aggressively, because we need to use the grid we've got better first and foremost. But a significant increase in electricity demand will definitely require the build out of more end connections for the grid. And that just is difficult in Europe because of our heritage, our planning process, our lack of ability to align around a single plan. You know, whereas in China, rolling out the grid is easy, right? It's an engineering nation, and rolling out the grid is something that they have done very effectively. And so for them, electrification of trucks is quite easy in a way, because, you know, I want a grid connection, I get a grid connection, and electricity is cheap. So it's quite easy to do, really.
I'm the one thing that we've not talked about, and I can't believe that we've got this far in and we've not mentioned it, is the OEMs. So, you know, Scania, Mercedes, Volvo, and so on, and so DAF and so on. I mean, are these the guys that you're going to... Because fundamentally, battery swapping is only ever going to work if the manufacturers adopt the technology, right? Because at the moment, they are perfectly happy sticking a charger on the left, a charger on the right, maybe MCS, blah, blah, blah. Nobody in the... that I'm seeing, and you probably have a view on this more than me, is adopting this technology. And how are you tackling the OEM side of it?
Yeah, so in China, there's 10 OEMs, so I think 16 different vehicle types on the HGV swapping network. So one of the steps in our process is to bring some Chinese OEMs to UK and European market. So that's competition directly with European OEMs.
Bringing the cat to the pigeons.
if the analogy works, yeah. Yeah. But I think... Yeah, also, I can't say where we are with every European OEM just yet because of their confidentiality. But let's say we're talking to four of the five biggest European OEMs about the process and the technology, the solution. There's also work being done by OEMs on things like standards, which is in the public domain. So I would say overall, we are confident in one or two European OEMs embracing technology, but probably not all of them by 2028. And ultimately, you've got to remember, you know, it is a complementary narrative. So if you take a step back, a battery swappable vehicle can CCS charge. It can't MCS charge, but it can CCS charge. So ultimately, by adding this solution into the ecosystem, you're already saying to a customer, here's another option to get the electricity into your vehicle. One is a swap, one is a charge. You can do whichever one you want, which works for your economics. So it's not like a either-or solution. Now, potentially, there is a narrative of, okay, but what about the battery ownership? What about what we've been saying to policymakers over the last X number of years? So there is differences, but I think on a... You know, if you take it back to first principles, it's not that big a deal.
I mean, it's amazing. And thank you for the answer. I'm not going to press you on you know, which, because obviously I respect that confidentiality. But this has been a super interesting. And honestly, Will, I think we could go on forever, but we've already taken a considerable chunk of time. And we don't want to keep you, and I think tennis might be calling. But we have a closing tradition here on the EV Cafe, and it is a very special one. And of course, you know all about it because, you know, you'll have listened to all of the podcasts because, you know.
Avid listener.
Yeah, you would have
plenty
prepared.
Of time.
You would have prepared. You would have made sure that you were ready for this moment in the podcast, which is where we present you with the EV Cafe magic wand. And here it is. Mm-hmm. And so
thank you very much.
With its lightning bolt, and it's going to come across the airwaves to a tennis court near you. And there we go. It's there. He's got it. He's got it. That's it. Excellent.
Every week.
Absolutely.
Just don't know why highly intelligent people do that. I just don't get it.
Because it works great. I like it.
Yeah, see, there you go. He's entering the spirit of the things. So, Will, yeah, we have now empowered you with the EV Cafe Magic Wand to kind of wish for whatever you want to wish for. I've got a couple of wishes for you, but I'm going to let you, you know, exercise your power of wish with the Magic Wand. Go for it. What do you think you would like to see?
Can I have the most boring wish ever? And it is really dry. So my macro wish, and I try and say this to everyone in the industry, across anyone who cares about sustainability, I'm like, look, the one thing you can do, the one thing everyone should ask policymakers for and businesses and to all lobby for the same thing, is make electricity cheaper. Because if electricity is cheaper, or the economics win for more and more applications, and therefore it's easy to electrify things, which is good for the planet. So my big bugbear is when people are like, oh yeah, but we need a scheme for this and a scheme for that and a grant for this. And I'm just like, just make electricity cheaper and all of those things will fall into place in your business model anyway. So my big wish is just make electricity cheaper. Like, and because you've got to remember, the cost of generation, you know, I can go sign a PPA in Spain for £20 a megawatt hour, and I will end up delivering the power to the customer at £120 a megawatt hour. In the UK, I can sign an offshore wind PPA for £100 a megawatt hour-ish, and I'm going to sell it at £250 a megawatt hour. That delta, yes, some of it's grid, some of it's imbalance, some of it, but a big chunk of it is just stuff that doesn't need to be there. So just make electricity as cheap as possible. And that is what China has got right. In China, it's about 5p a kilowatt hour for electricity. And it turns out loads of stuff gets electrified without an awful lot of master planning onto the back of it. So make electricity cheap and everything else is done. So that'll be my one macro wish.
I love that. How simple. How absolutely brilliantly simple. John, this has been a fabulous conversation, hasn't it?
It's just inspiring. Yeah, and I've taken something away from it, which is very personal, which is your ability, Will, to make something very complex sound very simple. But actually, if you have belief in what you're doing, then go for it. Just give it a go. I think the words you used were, how hard can it be? And we've, as the human race, we have achieved incredible things. Just give it a go. Put your best foot forward and try. And you do it with a smile. You do it with humility. You do it with massive intelligence that you hide well because you make things so simple. But there's a real brain kicking in there, which is phenomenal. And we've scratched the surface of the surface today. There's so much in you, and I'm heartened that you are one of the people with a vision to go and change the way we do stuff. It's been a real privilege to speak to you, and I hope we get to do this again.
Thank you, very kind.
I can only reflect in a similar way. When I was really excited when you said yes, and it is not disappointed, because I think what you are at the helm of right now has the power to make a global difference, you know, in terms of the way that we get stuff around. It's going to support autonomy, it's going to support electrification, it's going to support a logistics industry that has long been challenged, and I think there's a possibility that could change for the good. And at the heart of it, you're demonstrating what the art of the possible is, even within a big company, you know, and just kind of well done to Octopus for giving you the reins that they've given you, but well done to you for just having a go and, you know, getting cracking, and it's brilliant. And I will be watching this journey closely, because and also if you want to throw Vans in there somehow, then I'd be really grateful, because I think van or battery swapping could work for Vans too. But Will, you're a delight to talk to, mate, and I really believe that you will be successful, because you're doing things in a way that looks like it's going to really work effectively. So really well done, mate. I'm so excited for you.
Thank you very much again.
No, it's our pleasure. It's our pleasure. So,
isn't it interesting how people who achieve stuff sometimes find recognition so difficult to handle? Yeah, thanks very much.
my use of my kids murdered at me about everything I do, so.
You're amazing, Will. Well done, mate.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Bless it.
Yeah, pleasure.
I kind of feel we've left a load of things on the table, but maybe that means we'll have a conversation another day, because, you know, family.
We do a part two once we've got the network going and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to come and see it. We're going to come and see Swaptopus live, and see the ones where those first trucks that actually make that swap happen. That's what we'd like, Will. So
yeah,
just remember us when that day comes, because
I will do.
It'll be very good. But listen, guys, that has been super interesting, and I'm so grateful to Will and for sharing so candidly about this journey. It's been fantastic. It really gives me confidence that the future's in good hands for trucks and battery swapping. And I still think it's got to go down in history, the name Swaptopus. It is, it's pretty damn cool. But anyway, listen, if you've enjoyed this conversation, please share it with others, encourage other people to listen to it. Leave us a review. That would be fabulous. Also, head over to the website where you can find lots more. Now, connect with Will on LinkedIn. Follow this journey of Swaptopus and Octopus and just all of that, because I think you will be so encouraged as you do. So have a great day, everybody, and we look forward to seeing you next time.